One of you African brothers from Uganda said I didn't say anything about Africa. Had I been there? Well, yes, I have. In fact, I was there this past March. And I've been in most of East Africa and West Africa and a little bit in the middle. And Africa today is urbanizing faster than any other major geographical area in the world. It's growing at 4.5% per annum, urban. There's a massive migration. Africa was the last major area of the world to urbanize, and it's coming in like a storm. In fact, those percentages are about the same as Mexico City and Sao Paulo, Brazil, back in the 60s. And you know what that was? Cities growing at 800,000 to a million a year. And this is happening in Africa. And the churches are panicking as to how to deal with it, all the problems. And so everything we're talking about has a lot of application for Africa. Don't think it doesn't, because this part of the world is going to have a lot of big cities before very long. Well, this hour, we're going to talk about God's urban workers. And I want to read from a key passage, 1 Corinthians chapter 3, beginning at verse 9. 1 Corinthians chapter 3, and I'm going to give you a mantra. Christians usually don't have mantras, but it sounds like it's Hindu, but the word is okay. A mantra is a pithy saying in few words that drives home an enormous truth. And I'm going to give one to you from one of the verses here, but first we're going to read the passage. Now, sometime I'm going to design my own lectern. I have a theology of the architecture of pulpits and lecterns. And I think the devil gets into the design of some pulpits. I can't help but tell you this. You know, in these avant-garde churches today, you don't have the usual, well, certainly nothing like this, but you don't even have big wooden pulpits. You have just a little stand, or now transparency is being applied to pulpit gear, and you're supposed to be able to see the preacher. You're not supposed to be hiding behind something. Well, the point is that some of us need to hide a little bit, because I was on a platform a while back, and I was sitting behind the major speaker. This was a big name guy, you know. Everybody knew him. And from the waist up, he was the picture of poise. He didn't show any fear of anything. His gestures were just perfect, and he held the audience spellbound. But the bottom half, which I could see sitting back here, the guy was trembling. He had twitches. He had one leg that was kind of twitching. I don't know what he's going to do with one of these see-through pulpits that they have. Now, how'd I get into that? Let's read this very key passage, 1 Corinthians chapter 3, beginning at verse 9. For we are God's fellow workers. There's our theme, we're God's fellow workers. You are God's field, God's building. By the grace God has given me, I laid a foundation as an expert builder, and someone else is building on it. But each one should be careful how he builds. For no one can lay any foundation other than the one already laid, which is Jesus Christ. The words I want to leave with you especially. Verse 11. Each one should be careful how he builds. That's verse 10. Each one should be careful how he builds. Be careful how you build. Let me tell you about Pastor Peanut. I got to know Pastor Peanut in Santo Domingo, Dominican Republic, a couple of years ago. And I heard about this man because he had a remarkable record of planting churches. He was about 55, 60 years old when I talked with him and interviewed him, and he had already planted more than 20 churches. He said he started some others that didn't survive, but he had 20 churches that he could identify, the ones he had started over the course of his life. All of them in and around Santo Domingo. Well, I wanted to get to know this man. I'm always curious about people whom God uses in special ways, and I like to ask them some questions. And I found him in his carpenter shop. Besides his pastoral and evangelistic work, he's a carpenter, makes very nice furniture, which he sells. And I conducted this kind of informal interview while he continued to work, which immediately told me something about one of the characteristics I will mention later, that he esteemed the value of time. We talked, he could talk very well, but all the times his hands were busy. He had some furniture to complete. I appreciated that. A bright man, not a whole lot of education. Though he spoke three languages, preached from the Bible in three languages, he had three Bibles lying there on his bench, one in French, because he originally came from Haiti and had been schooled in French as well as Creole. He had a Creole Bible, and he had a Spanish Bible, and he could use all three of those languages very, very readily. Now, for us Americans, that's really a fantastic thing, you know, because we're mostly monolingual. But for some of you, I'll bet you some of you people probably know three or four or five or more languages because you've grown up in communities where different languages were spoken. Pastor Peanut, by the way, his name is Peanut, not because he's such a little guy. He is sort of small, and certainly not Peanut in the sense of not amounting to very much, as we sometimes use the expression in English. He's just a peanut. Now, his name in Creole is Money, which means peanut. And somehow he has gotten that label. He's Pastor Peanut, so that's what I call him too. He was a man of great spiritual vitality. To talk with him gives you the impression you are in the presence of a real saint of God. He doesn't wear it all out on his sleeve, so to speak, but you understand very soon that this man lives close to God, and he has a passion for souls. And I'll talk about this in a minute, but you know, he also knows what he's doing. Not only when he's building furniture, maybe this is where he's learned the lesson. If you're going to design a chair, you better have some kind of plan in mind, or someone's going to be on the floor at some time. You don't want a house built by someone who has no plan or real idea of what he's doing, do you? You want somebody who knows what he's doing. And as I talked with him, he described his method. A simple method, again involving a lot of walking and talking to people and praying with people. Praying for healing. He's reformed, I guess. But he also believes in healing. And he says, you know, God is great. God hears prayer. He prays for sick people wherever he can find them. Asks that they would like to have prayer. And a man who has a method that he follows and is able to adapt to different conditions and circumstances and follow through until he has a church. Now, I want to suggest that we can learn a lot from Pastor Peanut, a man who's started a number of churches. And I want you to keep Pastor Peanut in mind as we look at some of the things that I've put on your outline. And then keep that mantra in your mind, too. Be careful how you build. Be careful how you build. If we want to be successful urban workers, here are some things we need to focus on, each one of them, and keep growing in them as long as we live. And the first, of course, is our spiritual life. Our spiritual life and fellowship with God. You would think that seminaries would be hothouses of spiritual fervency. But that isn't always true. Many a seminarian says that his spiritual life suffered during his school days. Now, maybe that doesn't happen here. But I can tell from your expressions, you know what I'm talking about. And that is something you have to be very aware of. There are pastors, friends, who have been in the ministry a long while. And some of them even have sort of big names, but whose lives, their spiritual lives, are in tatters. Some of them have secret sins that they've covered up for a long time. Many of them are not practicing any kind of devotional discipline. They don't have prayer time. They're peanuts in that ugly sense of being spiritual midgets, even though they exercise leadership. Now, that's number one, and I would urge you to discipline yourself right now, in school, young as you may be, in the spiritual disciplines that are going to give you the strength to be men and women of God over the long haul, when you're going to face a lot of things that will test you. Spiritual fervency doesn't just happen. It has to be nurtured and kept alive over the long haul. Second, love for people. I've already mentioned this earlier, love for people. Paul says in Philippians chapter 1, I have you in my heart. Can we say that about the people to whom we speak and preach and minister to? I have you in my heart. And that means they'll be in your prayer list too. And the church directory will become your prayer list as you pray for the people to whom you minister and who depend upon you for their spiritual sustenance. I have you in my heart is a good mantra to keep in mind. Some years ago, I have a close friend in Mexico City. He's just now retired. He was a Catholic priest for 12, 13 years, and he became an evangelical through. Well, I'll tell you how he became. He was a Catholic priest who took his sacerdotalism so seriously. You know, if you really take sacerdotalism seriously, that means that people's eternal destiny depends on their getting the grace of the sacrament, which means if you're the only priest for 14, 15,000 people, you've got a lot of work to do. And he took that very seriously. He really believed the Catholic doctrine that grace was bestowed through the administration of the sacraments, and people to be saved needed his ministry. He had three cars, three drivers. He had kind of a bed in the back of a couple of his cars. He could sleep, take a nap, because he was going constantly until he worked himself into a nervous breakdown and landed in a hospital. And lo and behold, the best hospital in Guadalajara at that time was a Baptist hospital. And this Catholic priest had a Baptist doctor talk to him. He said, Father, you're going to kill yourself. And I want to tell you, there's another way. And if you'll listen, I'll tell you about it. And there in the hospital, suffering from a complete physical and mental or emotional breakdown, he became a follower of Jesus Christ. And he had to escape. Guadalajara in those days was intensely anti-Protestant. He had to go to Denver for a few months because they were out to kill him. And he came back, became a Presbyterian pastor. And I participated in his ordination as a Presbyterian pastor, and we became very close friends. And he was pastoring a church, in a large church in Mexico City, one of the largest Presbyterian churches. And he had a problem in his Sunday school. And he said, "Rogelio, can you help me with this Sunday school? Parents are complaining, children don't like it, teachers are quitting. I don't know what's wrong there." He says, "We've got the best superintendent. The director of the seminary, the Sunday school, has a PhD from the University of Mexico in education. A very bright guy, very IQ out of sight, and it should have been running very well." So I spent some time in the Sunday school there and just attended classes, talked to teachers, talked to everybody, and got a little handle on what I thought was happening. So then I sat down with the director. And I said, we talked about a lot of things, and I said, "Now, how do you explain all the trouble that seems to be constantly fermenting in your Sunday school?" Well, he said this and he said that. And finally, he became very honest. And he said, "You know, the problem is I don't like children." He says, "I love to organize. We have the best materials. This organization is the best Sunday school in Mexico City." But he says, "Those children." Well, you see, there was his problem. He didn't like children. And you know, people know when you like them or not. When you love them. When we can say like Paul, "I have you in my heart." Remember, as I said earlier, we've got to love people more than books. And sometimes we get the impression that ministry is all books. Well, books are important. But people have to know you love them. You have time for them. "I have you in my heart," said Paul. He had it right. Third, knowledge of Scripture, theology, and the ability to communicate it. We talked about the need for a theology big enough for the city. And that much could be said about that. Praise the Lord for Calvinism, the breadth and depth of its perspective. Calvinism is a theology designed for the city. Calvin, Geneva, urban man, like Paul. But you got to also be able to communicate. Now, the problem is that sometimes we are imbalanced in this whole matter, again, of what really constitutes effective ministry. And frankly, I hear a number of preachers who maybe they've got their theology right, but they'll put the angels to sleep. They don't communicate it well. And one of the reasons why so many young people are leaving some of our churches and going to these mega churches, this emerging church movement, which I'd love to talk to you about, is because we've delivered the best food, spiritual food, but we've delivered it poorly. And that's tragic. That really is tragic. And I feel that this is one of the things we constantly need to grow in. To grow in our ability not only to know our Calvinistic perspective, but also how to address it. Tim Keller, there in Redeemer, you know, Manhattan, New York, is the most pagan part of the United States. And he goes there, and he and I were together on the faculty at Westminster Seminary back in the early 80s. And he left for higher things. Some people got a hold of him and said, "Tim, we need to start a church in Manhattan." "Ah, impossible." And they talked to him, and the vision developed, and he left the faculty to go and do what seemed impossible. Calvinism, conservative, evangelical faith in Manhattan, where everybody's there for the money. And he's done it. He's got 4,000 every Sunday morning. And he started 100 churches, or helped start, in the different languages. I don't know how many different languages in different parts. He's got a vision. He's got a church planting institute. But he has learned the secret of taking profound truth and packaging it in a way that communicates, drives to the heart, even of those who are skeptics and secular and come from all different backgrounds. Now, there's a challenge for us all. And you can get on his website, by the way, you can get lots of material from him and helps on how to do that. And when I've taught evangelistic preaching, I say, you know, read Keller. Figure out how he does it. Maybe his context is very different than the context you're going to have to preach in, but you've got to learn the secrets of taking God's wonderful truth and getting it down to where people can grasp it and where the Holy Spirit can plant it deep in their souls. Well, we keep working at that. Even at my age, I'm constantly working at it. And someday I'll learn it, but then I'll go to heaven. Number four, management of time. I just mentioned that. Management of time. Some of us go to work in cultures where time is viewed differently than we would like. In Africa, they have the saying, you know, you've got watches, but you never seem to have time. And we have plenty of time, and we don't have watches. And, I have above my desk at home a lot of little mantras, but this one is from Peter Drucker. Nothing else distinguishes effective people as much as their tender, loving care of time. We've all got just 24 hours a day. Nobody gets any more. And we can waste big hunks of it, or we can use it to advance God's kingdom. And every one of us should be reading books on managing one's time. Now, if you work in a culture where that kind of thing is very difficult to implement, you're going to go crazy sometimes. But I would challenge you. Give lots of love to people. Give them time as they need it. But tender, loving care of time is an important discipline in urban ministry. Urban life is fast and furious. Everything takes time. Getting from one end of the city to another, visiting, finding people, takes time. And if we waste some of it, it's irretrievable time. Number six, intercultural skills. I mentioned that Pastor Peanut can speak three languages, and he moves very easily from one culture to another. That's something that not everybody is able to do. I think it was Peter Wagner years ago who said that the distinctive gift of the foreign missionary is the ability to live and enjoy living in another culture. Some people just never succeed in that. But let me tell you, the city is a challenge for all of us. And developing intercultural skills, including learning another language, if that's where God is calling you, you got to think about that. Languages are tough, I know. And some of us are not particularly gifted in language learning, but it can be done. And it's not near as hard as Greek and Hebrew. So a spoken language is fun, because right away you start talking to people. And that helps a great deal. But the ability to not only live in another culture, enjoy living there, adapt to its ways, but also to communicate the gospel. You know, one of the one of the barriers always to the spread of the gospel is first of all language, but also culture. And each culture requires careful examination. How do you communicate in this culture these eternal truths? And that's a challenge. We have to keep growing in it. I've lived 20 years overseas, but I'm still trying to learn better how to do it. I'm going to be teaching a course in Mexico City on missionary apologetics in February, and constantly, every waking moment that I'm not thinking about something else that's urgent, I'm thinking about how to help. I'm not a Mexican, and I'm going to have a whole class of Mexican pastors and evangelists who are given the assignment of defending and communicating the faith against all the different kinds of notions and religious ideas in Mexico. How to do that? And I know I'll probably fail a good percentage of the time because I'm not in their shoes. I don't feel as they feel about the issues of their time, but I've got to help them. And I'm thinking of all kinds of practical ways to get them to wrestle with the challenges they face. Now that's what mission work in the city is about, and there's all kinds of folks we got to deal with. It's a big challenge. The movement to suburbia has been the search for homogeneity. To live in a neighborhood, to go to a church where everybody looks like us, talks like us, understands us, and eats food like us. But cities are places of great heterogeneity. And to survive there and to minister there and to be happy there requires intercultural skills. And make sure your spouse gets them too. Because if she doesn't, or he doesn't, you're going to have big problems. Ability to evangelize and organize. Well, we've already touched on some of that, and I'm not going to say much more, except that, we got something funny going on in missions right now. Two of the major boards are going in rather opposite directions. You've got one very large mission agency, the Southern Baptists, who are going pell-mell in the direction of almost exclusive emphasis upon multiplying churches. In North America, they're targeting the new immigrants from all over the world. Overseas, they are pulling back on theological education, leadership training, and focusing on rapid multiplication of churches. Others are going in a different direction, with apparent emphasis not so much on missionaries planting churches as teaching, training leaders, leaving church planting evangelism to nationals. Now, there's something to be said for all of that. But there are also some pitfalls. And I've kind of come out to the point where I think it's got to be both and. We may weight our emphasis a little bit more on one than the other, depending on the situation. But as you look around the world, situations differ so much. Needs are different. The strength of the national churches is different in one place and another. That you can't just adopt one formula and say, "Now this is what we're going to do everywhere." I think that is a recipe for failure. However, the point is that we need to constantly be training leaders. I've developed almost a mantra of saying I will only work where I can train trainers, because I don't have that many more years to be doing other stuff.
I want to invest my energies into training trainers who will train still more trainers. And I think that's the Pauline method. He was constantly, if you read those chapters we referred to this morning, Acts 18, 19, 20, he was surrounded by people. He's always accompanied by this and that name, and most of those were Greek names. And you look at the last chapter of Romans 16. By the way, right smack in the middle of this wonderful chapter that begins with all these salutations to all his wonderful fellow workers. And he praises the different people for all they've done as co-workers of his. And then at the end there's that wonderful prayer and praise paragraph. But right in the middle, he's talking about the wolves. He doesn't call them wolves there, but he warns about the heresies that will come. And I think it's significant that Paul tucks that serious warning right in the middle of that glorious final chapter, his final word to the church at Rome. Now, Paul was always training people. And that was what we've got to do too. Organize, disciple, and strengthen the church. The church is not just a conglomeration of individuals, which today is one of the errors that we see in many of the American churches. You don't have members so much as attendees. We've got a mega church not too far from where I live. They have 10,000 people on Sunday. 70 to 80% of them are not members. The pastor preached a sermon a couple of weeks ago in which he said, and this was daring, he said, "I'm telling you, if you don't want to be a responsible member of this church, go on back to the churches you came from." Which in many cases are my denomination. So come on back, folks. You heard what the pastor said, now you do it. But it's so much easier just to be an attendee, isn't it? No responsibilities, really. No budgetary commitment. They can't come and tap you on the shoulder and say, "How come you're living with your girlfriend?" No, I'm just an attendee. I'm floating around. But that's a serious error. And it is a sign of a serious spiritual problem. And let's remember that when we hear all these big numbers and all the great things some churches are doing. What kind of training are they really getting? Let me ask yourself that. Well, number 7, sensitivity to the poor and the hurting. There are lots of them in the city. Lots of them in the city. You can't do urban work without dealing with the poor and the needy. Well, I guess you can, but then I think you're not being faithful. It's striking to me that the Apostle Paul, in that very chapter we read, and we didn't take the time to take note of it really, in that very same chapter, Acts 20, talks about his hard work in order to meet the needs of himself and his companions. "In everything I did, I showed you that by this kind of hard work we must help the weak, remembering the words of the Lord Jesus, 'It is more blessed to give than to receive.'" I think he's referring to a diaconal ministry that he himself practiced and he left as part of his instruction to the church. The weak, the needy, they're all around us. And the church in the city has to be a compassionate community. Can't do everything. And the needs are more than any one church or even a whole denomination can meet. But we shouldn't wait for a tsunami or a hurricane to bring out our concern for people in destitute conditions.
One of the tests, one of the signs of a truly Christian church is its compassion for the poor and the needy. You know, Pastor Peanut doesn't have much money. He supports himself largely because he wants to do it that way. But he has a way of approaching the poor whom he visits, and his method of house-to-house visitation gets him into all kinds of situations. You never know what's behind that closed door. And he uses prayer, as I said, as a missionary tool. And God does great things through him. But he also has a way of using limited means to considerably great things. He always has a way of meeting somebody's need, linking them up with some other one who has some resources, maybe something he knows about that will help them, a job that's open. He's sort of a walking diaconate. We've got to learn how to do that and keep growing in it. Opportunities to show compassion abound in the city. Well, ability to use money wisely, to earn money if need be. You know, the ancient rabbis were required to learn a trade. Maybe that's how Paul learned tent making. You have to have some kind of a marketable skill. I don't know what I would do necessarily. Raise dogs or something, maybe, I don't know. But in Hong Kong, the Chinese have several mission training institutes. And the one that I was invited to talk to teaches all outgoing Chinese missionaries, or going all over the world, how to set up a Chinese restaurant. Now, the whole world eats Chinese food, you know. And you can start a restaurant. I can tell you places that you can't believe there's a Chinese restaurant. I mean, but there'll be a restaurant, and it does good business. And Chinese are greatly skilled in setting up restaurants and preparing food that people will buy. Now, what greater skill? Like Paul, tent making was a good money maker because people didn't have all the hotels and motels we have today. They went all these games and the Olympics, and they traveled with tents. Tent making was a money making business. Now, many of us have grown up in denominations that frown on the pastor being bivocational. Some denominations practice it regularly and have for years, but many of us haven't. I'm suggesting that in the future, many churches are not going to be able to pay a decent salary, and we've got to learn how to be tent makers again, afresh, and missionaries particularly. And if you go into parts of the world that we call limited access countries, you're going to have a trade just to get in. And I can tell you examples of people who have built churches and have worked for years in a foreign culture as tent makers, professors at universities, and doing other things very successfully. It doesn't necessarily... There's two things about being a tent maker. Number one, it takes time away from what you might be thinking is your primary purpose for being there. It takes time and energy. However, it also opens doors. I'm thinking of my friend Gerald Nienhuis in Mexico City, who has built a great church of university-educated people, because he has taught for 30 years in two different Mexican universities. He's a skilled teacher, excellent in Spanish, and he always can get a job part-time in a university. And how better to meet students and future leaders than a university campus? And he's done that for years. But we know when he began 40 years ago, you know what he did to learn street Spanish? He read comic books.
You buy these pictorial comic books, you know? Why? Because that's the language of the street. He already had a doctorate. He was an educated man. But he wanted to be able to talk to ordinary Joes. So he read the comic books and learned that vocabulary. And then he could go on to other things. And he did. But you see, he bridged the cultures, the language, with a goal in mind. And he was willing to do a double job. Teaching at a university, evangelizing, starting a church, and now he's got a fantastic church, largely consisting of university graduates.
Well, we got to hurry on. It's just about 12. Self-understanding. I'd like to spend more time on this. We can't do much, but let me say this. God wires each of us a bit differently.
No, two of us are exactly alike. And in leadership gifts, again, some of us are, I have a sort of a poor man's typology of leadership gifts. It's not sophisticated at all. MTW wouldn't think about this, but I tell you, I've tested it for a long time, and it helps a lot. Number one, you have initiators. Type one is an initiator. You always start something new. I know who I am, and I love to start something new. That's the trouble of being my age. You better not start too much because, you know, you're not going to be around to finish it. But initiators, they what gets them out of bed and turns their motor is starting something new. A new project, a new idea, boy, they go for it. The second type is the organizer. Now, organizers don't get a whole lot of new ideas and start new things, but they know how to organize. Sometimes this has to be the spouse. You know, the best salesmen, they don't even know how to keep the check stuff straight. But they're out there selling. Huh? They know how to do that. That's their gift. Well, an organizer, number two, is very, very important. Without that, you have chaos. Number three is a maintainer. A maintenance person. Now, a lot of people think today that maintenance is kind of a bad thing. If you're just a maintenance person, you just keep going, hey, that's a wrong idea. A good maintenance pastor, we need tens of thousands of them. Because if you don't, you're going to have big trouble. Then you're going to need number four, the fourth type, which is the reformer, the renewer, the revitalizer, the guy who picks up where somebody else has been and made a mess of it. Now, there you got those four types. Number one, the initiator, which makes good trailblazing pioneer missionaries. Then you got organizers who I think Paul surrounded himself with, the Timothys and Titus, that they had to go organize these churches, and Paul was on his way again. Number three, you got to have good maintenance back. My father pastored for 50 years, and he never started anything big that was altogether new. No, in the churches that he pastored, usually about 10 years, he'd move on. They were always better and stronger when he left than when he had come. But he never started anything big. He'd never make a missionary. He stayed within his culture, within his own niche. He knew how God had wired him, where his gifts were. He was an excellent maintenance pastor. And God bless all those who are good maintenance pastors. However, if you define maintenance as simply never changing anything, just keeping the ball rolling just the way it's always gone, before long you're going to have trouble. And then comes the number fourth, where somebody has to come in. The church has begun to cave in and there's a lot of dissension, and then you have to revitalize her. Now, what kind of person am I? What kind of person are you? It's a mistake to say that everybody's got to be an initiating church planter. Because it don't work. That's one of the secrets of the mission field. And some people just stay on and stay on and stay on, and they should have gone home a lot earlier or gotten into a different role. At the same time, you got to be careful where you put the initiator, because if you put them into a more maintenance situation, they're going to drive people wild. They're going to have a new idea every week,
And you've got to be careful. Know yourself. Don't get yourself into a role forced on you perhaps by church or agency that you are not fitted for. Because that's cruel and unusual punishment. Urban demographics. Study the city. Learn to love the city in all of its wonderful complexity, diversity, and embrace it. Like that out on the hillside waiting for Nineveh to burn. Friends, there's millions of people in those cities that need people with a heart for the city, like Pastor Peanut, who, with never owning a car of his own, but walking and talking about Jesus and praying with hurting people and helping wherever he could, planted more than 20 churches in the course of his life. We can learn a lot from Pastor Peanut. Thank you very much.